Welcome to Rural Ed Med. I am Serena Wilson, an acute care nurse practitioner, and I will be speaking about acute coronary syndromes. Acute coronary syndromes is a blanket term that encompasses three distinct entities presenting with cardiac chest pain. These include ST elevation myocardial infarction, or STEMI, non-ST elevation myocardial infarction, or non-STEMI, and USA, or unstable angina. Chest pain is a medical term and does not always refer to pain in the chest. Common cardiac pain locations include the left chest, substernal, or epigastric areas. Pain is usually described as pressure or squeezing. Women and the elderly may have atypical presentations of pain, such as right chest pain, left or right arm pain, or jaw pain. They may have sharp rather than dull pain. Diabetics or those on pain medications may not perceive pain at all. Their only symptoms may be fatigue and shortness of breath. Chest pain that occurs at rest and/or is new or increasing in frequency, intensity, and duration is considered high risk, even in the absence of serologic evidence of the cardiac damage. Chest pain that is associated with symptoms of diaphoresis, nausea, syncope, and shortness of breath is also usually high risk of being cardiac in nature. Occasionally, people will present in cardiac failure or shock. Acute myocardial infarction, or AMI, is caused by thrombus that either partially or completely occludes the lumen of a cardiac vessel. High-risk plaques leading to this condition are those with a high lipid content core and a thin fibrous cap. When these atherosclerotic plaques rupture, thrombi form within the vessel. A complete occlusion leads to the characteristic ST elevation on EKG and contiguous leads congruent with vessel location. Non-STEMI usually happens when a vessel is incompletely occluded. Platelet activation seems to have a large role in acute coronary syndromes, or ACS. A number of things are capable of inducing platelet activation, including the exposure to collagens contained in connective tissue, tissue factor contained within non-vascular cells, and intrinsic chemicals such as adenosine diphosphate, or ADP, thromboxane A2, serotonin, and even epinephrine. These responses partially explain the risk factors for cardiovascular disease. Physiologic doses of epinephrine, such as released in response to prolonged physiologic or psychologic stress, increases the sensitivity of platelets to the factors that activate them. Uncontrolled elevation of serum glucose, as can occur in diabetes, or blood pressure, as occurs in hypertension, can erode or cause shear stress to the lining of blood vessels, thus exposing collagen fibrils, or simply activating inflammation, which also activates platelets. Chemicals contained in tobacco also damage the lining of blood vessels, leading to activation of platelets. Your first example of a patient with chest pain is Gary, a 63-year-old male with past medical history of hypertension, rheumatoid arthritis, and coronary artery disease with prior stent placement. He presents with sudden onset of 20 out of 10 chest pain. He can't describe the quality, it just hurts. He describes the location of pain as substernal. It is associated with some shortness of breath. Onset was while he was watching TV. He has no history of cancer, recent surgery, or immobility. His blood pressure is 90 over 43, so you give morphine rather than nitro. He states that it does not help with the pain much, but he is starting to act very drowsy. An EKG shows nonspecific T-wave changes. Troponin is non-significantly elevated. His lung sounds are clear, but he has a small diastolic murmur. He is afebrile and without leukocytosis. D-dimer is mildly elevated. You order a fluid bolus and portable chest films rather than CT because of the hypotension. A number of other conditions can cause characteristic cardiac chest pain and even elevations in troponin. Your must-not-miss diagnoses are as follows. Aortic dissection can cause tearing chest pain, back pain, new murmur, unequal pulses, and neurological signs. It can usually be seen on chest x-ray as mediastinal widening, which is why these exams are done on most patients presenting with chest pain. Sometimes a CT or echo is needed. Tension pneumothorax will cause pleuritic chest pain and shortness of breath. This can easily be seen with a chest x-ray. Pulmonary embolism, or PE, is worrisome with chest pain that is sudden onset, and especially when accompanied by shortness of breath or hypoxia. Patients with PE may have unilateral leg swelling, tachycardia, tachypnea, or risk factors such as cancer, recent surgery, or prolonged periods of immobility. Esophageal rupture can also cause chest pain, especially of the epigastric or retrosternal regions. A chest x-ray also rules this out. Gary's chest films come back with a widened mediastinum. You suspect aortic dissection. D-dimer and troponin can both be elevated with this condition and in PE. Either are also often accompanied by shortness of breath. Shock, sedating medications, and lack of brain blood flow secondary to dissection can lead to neurological signs, including altered level of consciousness. Usually, patients with aortic dissection present with uncontrolled hypertension and tachycardia, which should be controlled to a systolic blood pressure goal of 100 to 120 and heart rate less than 60. Hypotensive patients with dissecting aortic aneurysm may have pericardial tamponade, acute blood loss, or valvular dysfunction. This is a surgical emergency. In rural areas, it is almost always a death sentence, as pericardiocentesis speeds up the process of shock and pressors increase shear stress on the vessel wall. Lucy is a 26-year-old female with no past medical history who presents with crushing chest pain. When emergency medical personnel try to lay her down on a gurney, she refuses, stating that the chest pain is much worse when lying down. The chest pain is also worse with coughing and deep breathing. Lucy does admit to having a cough lately. She is just getting over a cold. The chest pain is not reproducible with palpation, however. An EKG shows ST elevation in leads V2 through 6, 1, and 2. Her troponin is elevated at 8. She has mild leukocytosis and a fever of 100.1 Fahrenheit. Other non-emergent causes for chest pain include the following. Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is more common in young people and is usually accompanied by a harsh systolic murmur that increases in intensity as a patient bears down. An echo can usually rule this out. Coronary vasospasms can cause chest pain and changes in the EKG. A coronary angiogram is usually required to rule this out. Pneumonia may cause pleuritic chest pain, but is usually associated with cough, shortness of breath, hypoxia, and fever. Costochondritis, or intracostal muscle inflammation, can be confused for cardiac pain, but is usually reproducible with palpation. Pericarditis pain usually varies with position and causes global ST elevations, PR segment elevation, and/or global T-wave inversions. One might hear a pericardial friction rub with this condition. Finally, chest pain may be caused by esophageal spasms, which are also often relieved by nitro, reflux disease, and gastritis. Often these conditions are associated with some abdominal symptoms, such as pain or guarding. Cholecystitis and peptic ulcer disease can also mimic ACS. Lucy has pericarditis. Her ST elevations do not point to occlusions of any particular coronary artery. Leads V1 through V6, 1 and 2, are the most commonly affected leads in pericarditis. It is often caused by a virus, and viral upper respiratory infection symptoms may precede it. It can also be due to bacterial infection or malignancy. As an inflammatory response, leukocytosis and fever can accompany it. Pericarditis often causes elevations in cardiac enzymes. It is usually treated with colchicine and NSAIDs. Patients with elevated troponins have a poorer prognosis and are hospitalized. They are at higher risk for developing pericardial effusion with tamponade and clots. Any unrelieved ongoing chest pain is considered high risk and necessitates serial EKGs. The EKG is the single most important tool in evaluating suspected cardiac chest pain. The typical presentation of a STEMI is ST elevation of at least 0.1 millivolts or 1 millimeter, which is also one small box on the EKG paper, high, and must be present in at least two contiguous leads. Contiguous means leads indicating the same vessel or area of the heart that is experiencing damage. Leads 2, 3, and AVF indicate the inferior heart. V1 and V2 is septal. V3 and V4 is anterior. V5, V6, 1, and AVL are lateral. A posterior MI is not evaluated directly with a usual EKG. These present with ST segment depression and hyperacute R waves in the right precordial leads, or V1, V2. A posterior EKG can be done, which will show ST elevation in leads V7 through 9. Posterior MIs often coexist with inferior ones, so always suspect posterior in this case. This is true of right ventricular MIs as well. ST elevation for these would be in leads V1 and V4R. Right ventricular infarct is a little different than other types in that a patient with this is preload dependent. It should be suspected with inferior MI as well as in MI patients presenting with hypotension, tachycardia, and jugular venous distension with clear lung sounds. New left bundle branch block is also a sign of acute STEMI. Unfortunately, you may not always have an old EKG to compare, so it is hard to determine what is new. Leonard is a 62-year-old male with known coronary artery disease and congestive heart failure, or CHF, recent coronary bypass surgery, and he takes long-acting nitrates regularly for angina. He is visiting your rural town from out of state. It is Sunday, so you cannot obtain records for him today. He developed chest pain while helping his son pack up to move. The pain is described as similar to his usual pain, except that it did not go away with rest and short-acting nitrates. His EKG shows left bundle branch block. He does not know if this is new. He remembers there was something wrong with his last EKG, but that was when he got his bypass surgery. We used to believe that you could not diagnose a STEMI with left bundle branch block. Now we use Scarbosa's criteria, and this is endorsed by the American Heart Association. In a usual left bundle branch block, there are some normal ST elevations and depressions. The complexes are discordant at baseline. This means that leads with a predominantly positive QRS complex will have some measure of ST or J-point depression, and a predominantly negative QRS complex will have ST or J-point elevation. They will move in opposite directions. Patients with concerning symptoms, a left bundle branch block, and meeting Scarbosa's criteria should be taken for immediate invasive intervention. This is equivalent to a STEMI. There are three criteria that a left bundle branch block can meet. The first is concordant ST elevation of at least 1 millimeter or ST elevation in a lead that has a predominantly positive QRS complex. The second criterion is concordant ST depression in leads V1 through 3 or ST depression with predominantly negative QRSs in V1 through 3. Criteria 3 is discordant ST elevation or opposite the QRS as is usual in a left bundle branch block, but the ST elevation is greater than or equal to 1/4 the depth of the S wave in the same lead. Since the discordant QRS wave will be negative, the S wave is the downward going portion of the QRS. The ST elevation must be at least 1/4 the size. To be concerning, a person with a left bundle branch block only needs to satisfy one of the criteria, not all. The more criteria a person meets, the higher likelihood of an acute MI. The probability ranges from 50% if meeting only the third criteria to 100% if meeting all three. Keep in mind that developing a left bundle branch block during STEMI carries a very high mortality rate. Non-STEMI and unstable angina often show up as ST depression of at least 1 millimeter or deep inverted T waves on the EKG in two or more contiguous leads. Either may present with no EKG changes at all. They may cause elevations in troponin. Any patient suspected of having either of these syndromes should undergo a risk assessment scoring system. A TIMI score, or thrombolysis and myocardial infarction score, can be used to predict which patients will need urgent revascularization. This is a 7-point scoring system that includes risk factors. Any patient having either ST depression in contiguous leads or elevation in troponin should automatically undergo urgent revascularization. A patient having most or all of the other risk factors will also probably need this. Troponin I is a structural component of cardiac muscle and is released into the bloodstream during cellular necrosis. It is one of the three troponin proteins that is also includes troponin C and T. Troponins are responsible for the contractile motion of the heart. An elevated serum troponin greater than the 99th percentile normal is associated with a threefold increase in risk of recurrent MI or death. It can take 3 to 6 hours to even start elevating and peaks in about 12. It often stays elevated for 1 to 2 weeks after an acute event. Unfortunately, there are a couple of other reasons why troponin might be elevated. It can be mildly elevated with strenuous cardiovascular exercise, including with any form of tachycardia. Usually the kidneys will eliminate this as fast as it is released, but kidney disease can also lead to elevated troponins. This is true of troponin T mostly, which is broken down into smaller particles before being cleared by the kidneys. Unfortunately, kidney disease does not explain why troponin is released in the first place. Other forms of cardiac damage also cause a rise in serum troponin, such as congestive heart failure and pericarditis, although the reason is not altogether clear in either. About 3 to 5% of troponin I is contained within myocytes, which may explain mild elevations with the reversible ischemia accompanying congestive heart failure. Damage to myocytes is also the theory behind myocarditis elevations. CHF elevations can be due to increased wall stress associated with fluid overload as well. A common cause of elevated troponins in the inpatient setting is sepsis or severe infection. It can also be associated with ischemic stroke or subarachnoid hemorrhage, probably via abnormal autonomic activation. Troponin is usually not significantly elevated in unstable angina. It can be elevated following percutaneous intervention, but the degree of elevation is associated with a poorer prognosis. Treatment for STEMI is always the same, reperfusion therapy. There are two choices available. PCI, or percutaneous coronary intervention, refers to catheter-based therapy such as angiography with stent placement or balloon angioplasty. The second choice is thrombolytics. While thrombolytic use for indication of acute MI is well supported in the literature, PCI is associated with reduced rates of mortality, reinfarction, and stroke. Thrombolytics are usually reserved for centers that do not do PCI and whom cannot transfer for PCI within a reasonable time frame, usually considered under 90 minutes. Receiving thrombolytics does not preclude a patient from receiving PCI at a later date. Approximately 30% of patients receiving thrombolytics will require this therapy, so all patients should be transferred to a facility that is capable of this. A patient having cardiac stent placement will have either a bare metal or drug-eluting stent placed. Drug-eluting stents are less likely to reocclude over time, but require a longer duration of dual antiplatelet therapy following placement. Once the occlusion is opened up, therapy focuses on four major areas: prevention of reocclusion with antiplatelets and antithrombotics, prevention of cardiac remodeling with ACE inhibitors and beta blockers, anti-ischemic and anti-anginal medications such as nitrates, and cholesterol-lowering medications such as statins. Non-STEMI and unstable angina treatment is not as clear-cut. These patients are usually risk stratified to determine who needs reperfusion therapy right away and who can wait. The TIMI score for unstable angina and non-ST elevation MI is a seven-item scoring system used to predict outcomes in patients who are confirmed to have non-STEMI and unstable angina. Points are given for age greater than 65, greater than or equal to three coronary artery disease risk factors, known coronary artery disease, aspirin use in the last 7 days, greater than two episodes of severe angina in the last 24 hours, ST changes greater than or equal to 0.5 millimeters on an EKG, and positive cardiac markers. Cardiac risk factors include family history, diabetes, current smoking, hypertension, or hyperlipidemia. Each item is scored 0 to 1 for absent or present. It predicts a 2.5 to 41% of death, AMI, or need for urgent revascularization within the next 14 days. A score greater than or equal to 3 is considered intermediate to high risk. Also, any patient with ST deviations and elevated cardiac enzymes are immediately considered high risk despite TIMI scores. All high-risk patients should be considered for early invasive therapy, as only this group of patients have been shown to benefit from this course of action and studies. Non-STEMI and unstable angina patients should also be treated with the medications outlined for STEMI. Antiplatelets such as aspirin are always given upon presentation. Aspirin works via a chemical process that blocks thromboxane A2 production of platelets for the life of that platelet. Any platelet not synthesizing the chemical is less sensitive to ADP, epinephrine, arachidonic acid, and low doses of collagen and thrombin. Response to major doses of collagen and thrombin is preserved, however, limiting risks of life-threatening bleeding. A single dose of aspirin will increase bleeding times by about 1.2 to 2 times the pre-aspirin bleeding rates for 1 to 4 days. For those with severe aspirin allergy, there are newer antiplatelets such as Prosugrel and Ticagrelor. Prosugrel is more potent than clopidogrel in studies, but also carries a higher bleeding and fatal bleeding rate, especially in patients with prior stroke or TIA, age greater than 75, and those weighing less than 60 kilograms. All patients receiving reperfusion therapy should be treated with dual antiplatelet therapy. Usually, clopidogrel is added to aspirin. This combination is even recommended with concurrent administration of thrombolytics, especially during the first 24 hours. There are numerous trials comparing aspirin alone to aspirin and clopidogrel with a 9 to 36% reduction, depending on the study, in mortality rate, repeat MI, or stroke with dual therapy in both STEMI and non-STEMI. The American College of Cardiology, American Heart Association, and European Society of Cardiology all recommend aspirin for life, regardless of whether or not someone receives percutaneous intervention, and clopidogrel for at least 12 months, especially if the patient has a stent placed. Patients may stop clopidogrel for procedures or surgery if they have had at least 1 month of therapy. After a stent is placed, high-dose aspirin is given the first month, followed by a baby aspirin daily after that. The second agent, usually clopidogrel, is given for at least 2 weeks following bare metal stent placement in high-risk patients, and ideally for at least 12 months. Drug-eluting stents also require at least 12 months of dual antiplatelet therapy. This is because the risk of stent thrombosis, which occurs in approximately 20% of patients with bare metal stents within the first 30 days, or similar rates with drug-eluting stents greater than 1 year after placement. The problem with this is that stent reocclusion usually presents a sudden cardiac death. In patients suspected to need bypass grafting, the second agent should be a glycoprotein 2B3A inhibitor, such as Integrilin or Riopro. If a second antiplatelet agent was already added, then you realize that the patient will need bypass grafting, it is recommended that clopidogrel be stopped 5 days before this intervention and prosugrel 7 days unless the surgery is emergent. As you can see, the focus following acute coronary syndromes or ACS is antiplatelet therapy. Platelet activation is at the heart of pathogenesis for this disorder. Studies have shown that patients with ACS continue to have higher baseline levels of platelet activation than controls, even as far out as a month following the event. Obviously, antiplatelet therapy was not withheld in patients following ACS in these studies. For this effect to still be significant means the true value of continued platelet activation is probably quite large. Nobody knows exactly how long this elevation actually lasts. In addition, patients who receive cardiac stents have non-self introduced into the body. The body mounts an inflammatory response against the unrecognized stents, which again increases platelet activation. All of this is why dual antiplatelet therapy is recommended following ACS. You might remember that in stroke, patients are never given aspirin and clopidogrel together. It increases the risk of bleeding without improvement in mortality, morbidity, or recurrent events. Stroke is not accompanied by prolonged platelet activation. Remember that this is different. Warfarin is also occasionally used as a second agent after MI. Warfarin alone has comparable risk adjustments as aspirin alone, but with much higher bleed rates. When used with aspirin, it confers a mortality benefit and a lower risk of recurrent MI. Warfarin is recommended in atrial fibrillation. Unfortunately, in patients with drug-eluting stents, this does not replace dual antiplatelet therapy. There's very little research to guide decisions about this, but a low-grade recommendation from the American Heart Association is to give warfarin and dual antiplatelet therapy in this setting. The studies that have been done do suggest that a bleeding risk associated with triple therapy is no higher than that with dual antiplatelet therapy in these patients. Antithrombotics such as heparin and low molecular weight heparin are started in non-STEMI patients deemed to be high or moderate risk. These include patients with elevated troponin and ongoing ischemia or chest pain. Enoxaparin is generally preferred unless a person has baseline or new renal failure, is elderly, or in obese patients. These agents are started concurrently in patients receiving thrombolytic agents. Antianginals are used to provide relief of chest pain and to manage symptoms associated with heart failure. Nitrates are the most commonly used medications in this class. They can be given sublingual, oral, transdermal, or IV. They relax the smooth muscle that make up the walls of blood vessels, including the coronary arteries that feed the heart. Nitrates should not be given to patients who have used phosphodiesterase inhibitors such as Viagra or Cialis within the last 24 to 48 hours. They may cause hypotension. In patients unable to tolerate nitrates, morphine may also be used to relieve chest pain and pulmonary congestion. All patients with STEMI, non-STEMI, and unstable angina should receive a beta blocker if not contraindicated. Beta blockers reduce oxygen demand on the heart, decrease risk of commonly associated arrhythmias such as VFib and tachycardia, prolong diastole by lowering heart rate, thus providing increased oxygen to the heart, help to prevent ventricular remodeling and later resulting congestive heart failure, slowing progression of atherosclerosis in the coronary arteries, and inhibits platelet aggregation and activation. Beta blockers should be started within the first 24 hours of ACS. Obviously, they cannot be used in patients with hemodynamic instability, high-grade heart blocks, patients with bronchospasm or severe bradycardia, when AMI is related to cocaine use, and during an acute CHF exacerbation. All ACS patients are put on high-dose statin therapy as well. These lower cholesterol as well as have anti-inflammatory properties on vessel walls. Through unknown mechanisms, statins also seem to lower the incidence of atrial fibrillation after ACS. ACE inhibitors block the renin-angiotensin system, resulting in decreased cardiac wall stress, decreased sympathetic tone and thus the workload of the heart. They lower blood pressure, decrease the incidence of later developing or having worsening of heart failure, and may decrease the risk of sudden cardiac death. They do decrease the overall cardiac mortality rate following AMI. They are started in patients with an EF less than 40%, with hypertension, or even in diabetics following STEMI, and less frequently in non-STEMI. Finally, risk factor modification is absolutely essential following any type of ACS. Some factors aren't modifiable, such as age and genetics. The ones that can be controlled include hypertension, glycemic control, smoking status, diet, exercise, and stress management. Cardiac rehabilitation programs often address all of these factors and have been shown to improve mortality. Complications of ACS range from mild to life-threatening and occur early or late following AMI. Of these complications, bradydysrhythmias are the most common. These frequently occur secondary to blocks and conduction delays. Ischemia or necrosis of the conduction system of the heart can lead to these problems, as can autonomic imbalance. 40% of patients with inferior MI will have sinus bradycardia during the first 2 hours following the event. That number drops to 20% after that. This is usually attributable to increased vagal tone early and ischemia of the sinus or atrial node later. First-degree block is also common in inferior MI for the same reasons. About 3.2% of patients with anterior MI develop high-grade heart block. Complete heart block can come on suddenly during the first 24 hours following anterior MI and carries a very high mortality rate. This type of heart block is sometimes preceded by new right bundle branch block with accompanying fascicular block. Medications used in the treatment of ACS, such as beta blockers, can also lead to bradydysrhythmias. Atrial fibrillation following ACS is less common, but occurs due to sympathetic stimulation, coronary artery disease to arteries supplying the SA and AV nodes, with pericarditis and heart failure, and rarely with infarction or ischemia of the atrium. Finally, junctional tachycardia can occur transiently following MI. It usually resolves by 48 hours and does not require any specific therapy. Because of its wide QRS, it can sometimes be confused with VTAC. This rhythm is much slower and T waves can be visualized. Mechanical complications of MI include free wall rupture, rupture of the intraventricular septum, and acute mitral regurgitation. The incidence and severity of these complications is dependent on the degree and location of infarction. Free wall rupture sounds a little more catastrophic than it is usually, although there are cases of sudden cardiac death. I still remember my first free wall rupture as a new grad nurse. The guy had an anterior STEMI and was taken to the cath lab. He has stents placed and was recovering in the progressive care unit. He was in his late 70s and had no history of prior coronary artery disease. Overnight, he developed chest pain and nausea. When I assessed him, I discovered a cardiac murmur that hadn't been present before. Long story short, he had a free wall rupture. I remember picturing that as the left ventricle basically exploding. I couldn't figure out why everyone was moving so slow to help him, or even how he was alive. The rupture is usually a spontaneously occurring slit in the left ventricular wall. Typically occurs with incomplete reperfusion and in patients having their first MI. It is more common in STEMI. If it is incomplete or a slit, the pericardium can reseal itself over time. It can also be surgically repaired. Complete rupture results in tamponade and death. Intraventricular septum rupture occurs between 3 and 5 days or up to 2 weeks following an MI. It too occurs more frequently in first-time MIs. Patients usually present with hypotension, heart failure, and a new harsh holosystolic murmur. These patients will continue to have ST elevation on their EKGs beyond 72 hours following reperfusion. Treatment includes stabilization with vasodilators, inotropic agents, and intra-aortic balloon pump, followed by surgical repair. Severity depends on the degree of right-to-left shunting. Papillary muscle rupture usually occurs 2 to 7 days after AMI. It happens with STEMI and non-STEMI. It presents with a new loud holosystolic mitral regurgitation murmur. New mitral regurgitation also follows MIs due to papillary dysfunction, left ventricular remodeling, and aneurysms. Treatment of significant mitral regurgitation murmurs centers on afterload reduction with nitrates, nitroprusside, diuretics, and intra-aortic balloon pumping. Mitral regurgitation due to papillary muscle rupture should be surgically repaired and may need to be done emergently. Peri-infarction, pericarditis, can occur during the first 2 to 3 days following MI. Unlike regular pericarditis, EKG changes may be difficult to see through the ST changes associated with the MI itself. A pericardial friction rub auscultated during this time period is diagnostic. While this disorder portends a worse diagnosis, it is usually self-limited and requires no treatment. It may or may not be accompanied by chest or back pain. If symptoms are bothersome, these patients are treated with aspirin and colchicine. Other NSAIDs and glucocorticoids should be avoided for 7 to 10 days following any MI. Their use in this time frame is associated with a higher incidence of free wall rupture and aneurysm formation. Pericardial effusion is fluid around the heart. It is fairly common following MI and slow to reabsorb, with some persisting beyond a year after MI. There's a very small chance of tamponade with these effusions unless there is concomitant free wall rupture. Anticoagulation and antiplatelets can still be used in these patients. Post-MI pericardial effusions are usually asymptomatic. Post-cardiac injury syndrome following AMI, or Dressler syndrome, presents with a pericardial friction rub, fever, elevated white count, and chest pain that is usually pleuritic in nature. Sometimes these patients also have pulmonary infiltrates and/or pleural effusion. This is a late complication of MI, presenting within weeks to months. This disorder is exceedingly rare in this age of ACS treatment. It is mediated by the immune system and usually responds to NSAIDs and steroids in refractory cases. To wrap things up, chest pain is not synonymous with acute coronary syndromes. Anything from aortic dissection to PE to muscle strain to pneumonia can cause chest pain. Most ACS will not show the tombstones characteristic of STEMI, so an EKG, while important to identify, does not do anything to rule out AMI. Troponin is your greatest tool to rule out. If it is mildly elevated, look for other reasons the patient may have increased troponin, such as tachycardia, PE, renal failure, or heart failure exacerbation. Be careful with heart failure because an MI can set off an exacerbation. Very high troponins always mean myonecrosis, so take them seriously. Troponin can take time to elevate following an event, so check it serially. If it is not elevated, calculate a TIMI score to determine who should be monitored, immediately reperfused, and who can safely be discharged. Chest pain and arrhythmias following reperfusion do not necessarily indicate reinfarction or occlusion. There are a number of early post-MI complications that also cause these symptoms. As always, I encourage comments and discussion on my website. If you enjoy listening, leave a review on iTunes. Most importantly, thanks for listening.